Good afternoon, and welcome to the present session. We're very excited about this session. We've been looking forward to it for quite some time. Again, I have just a fantastically erudite and highly knowledgeable panel, all good communicators, and I'm looking forward to the session. We're going to be very, very brief on the introductions so that we can spend the vast majority of our time listening to these great presentations and having an opportunity to have some input from the audience. There was a very specific reason we chose this title. We've been talking about health equity in this country for a while now, and we've also more recently been talking about the recognition, probably from the WHO report, that the issues of health equities and inequities, et cetera, is both between and within countries. So there is a notion of global health equity that we also have to find a way to address if we are to have a healthy environment around the world, one that's supportive of people's growth and development, independence, end of wars, famine, et cetera. So we're really happy to be here this afternoon. We have, I think all four of the presentations will be from here. This is a very strange setup as I walked into the room, through the podium here and the table over there, but that's what we got to work with. Also, let me tell you that on the program, the Minister of Health from Taiwan is listed as one of the presenters. He could not be here due to issues at home of importance at home, but Dr. Steve Kuo is here to represent him, and I'm sure he will do a more than credible job. The order of presentations will be it was up there on the screen. We're going to start with Dr. John Kim Andrus, Deputy Director of PAHO, from World Health Organization. Then we'll move to the others as we go down the line. We'll just have a brief introduction with each presenter. So I'm going to ask Dr. Andrus if he'd come up to the podium. He's taller than me, and that's very unusual. So we're going to go out and play some basketball after the presentation.
Thank you. I'm delighted and honored to be here. I'll be speaking on issues related to universal health coverage through the perspective of the Americas. I'll be raising challenges throughout my talk. It's one of the topics that myself and my director, who has very much of a passion, she ran on this theme to be elected the director of the Pan American Health Organization, Dr. Carissa Etienne. And she often relates how people ask her, this is a very abstract concept, what do we mean by it? And so hopefully by the end of my presentation, you'll get an idea of what we mean by it. Does it include primary health care? Yes, it does. Is it only about primary health care? Certainly not. And that's the key message I would like to leave you with. We believe that it is a spectrum of services that cover health promotion, prevention, treatment, palliation, rehabilitation, and follow-up. It's built upon guiding principles of equity, of achieving and sustaining wellness, of tackling the social determinants of health. I'm so pleased that Dr. Satcher is here to address that in his presentation. So as E.O. Wilson once said, and define civilization. Civilization is organized kindness. And that's our challenge, to put this package of services into an organized, well-coordinated approach that will be different country by country. There's no one common solution for all our countries. I'm going to start off by showing you some data to put this in perspective of where we've come from, where we are now, and from these data illustrate challenges. I think we all can agree that maternal mortality in the Americas, as with other regions of the world, is the one MDG that we have failed. If you look at that top blue box, and we just look at averages, In 1990, maternal mortality in Latin America and the Caribbean was about 140 per 100,000 live births, and it's since dropped to 80. That's a 41% reduction, far short of the two-thirds we'd like to see. But if we remove the outliers and do a median analysis, as you see in the graph at the bottom left, looking over the years 1990 to 2010, the picture is even bleaker. There's been a less of a reduction. And those couple of outliers that you see represented by the dots are consistently countries like Haiti and Bolivia, our poorest countries. So if we agree that a maternal death in 99.9% of the cases is preventable, is totally unacceptable, perhaps we should be using that as an indicator of where, if we are achieving universal health coverage in the future going after 2015. We'll get back to that point towards the end of my presentation. We're also challenged by the demographic changes we're seeing, as well as the epidemiologic changes. This slide illustrates the demographic transition, comparing data from 1950 to 2010 on the right. On the left, 1950, looking at the proportion of the population, male in blue, female in orange color, by age groups. And you see clearly we are unquestionably older today than we were back in the 1950s. And this presents tremendous health challenges. Even in a country like Guatemala, where you see on the graph on the right the proportion of deaths attributable to, in blue, infectious diseases, so that blue, light blue color on the bottom, red being chronic disease. So for the first time in history, more people are dying of chronic disease than infectious disease, even in a country like Guatemala. And it's also about human rights. We are looking at data comparing 1990 to 2011 for water, safe water coverage in the Americas, broken down by urban on the left and in the middle rural and the aggregate total on the right. But if you focus on the rural, you see that the blue are more or less accepted safe water sources, either piped or some other improved water source. You still see, you see that particularly in rural populations, we have a long ways to go in terms of achieving equity for such a basic human right as water and sanitation. Earlier this morning, I had the privilege of participating on a panel highlighting the progress with the initiative to eliminate cholera transmission on Hispaniola. And we are very concerned, not just about Hispaniola, but the global threat we are facing. Because we know in the Americas there are vulnerable populations in every country, even the United States. And we now have an outbreak in Mexico. We've had exportations to France, Germany, Italy, Venezuela, and Chile. And so huge challenge going forward. And it's not, it's no coincidence that in the United States in particular, and this is most likely the same country by country in Latin America, that the fattest states are the poorest. So what universal health coverage is not, as I stated at the beginning, it's not about treating disease. It's not about financial protection only. We could talk for hours about that, but I just want to bullet it. And it's not about just ensuring a basic package of services, because we're talking about promotion and wellness and other issues. And it's not only about privatizing the health system. In fact, in Latin America, probably the poorest services are delivered by private entities. It's really a public health government, and it's about government ownership and accountability. So it's defining a new model of care that will certainly embrace primary health care, but a major focus on prevention and promotion that I mentioned, the social determinants. It's not about excluding priority programs. It's about embracing them and creating the capacity to do a better job with them. So it's about combining the issues of systems with the issues of disease prevention and control, certainly HIV, TB, malaria, and so on. We discussed the future challenges of chronic disease, but there's also rising elements of violence. And you saw in the data that I presented in Guatemala the rising incidence of accidents and accidents associated with violence. And it's also about quality of care. The water data that we see coming from Haiti, yes, there's been progress in implementing solutions, but when you go back to a, quote, safe water source that has had an implementation of an intervention and you test that water, it's still unsafe. So it's about sustaining the intervention and the quality as well. So we believe that the enabling conditions will include a larger budget. We believe that out-of-pocket payments at the point of service is a major barrier. This is what we've experienced in Latin America and the Caribbean. And we believe that increasing prepayment through health insurance and or taxes with pooling will also help reduce the inequities and open doors for the provision of these services. It's about enabling governments to do a better job, to be more accountable. In some countries, increasing the budget may not be the solution. It may be the efficiency of work or the quality of work. So it again highlights that it'll be country by country looking at the evidence, but including those basic guiding principles that I mentioned. And it's about people. It's about the workforce. And it doesn't always have to be a doctor wearing a stethoscope and a white coat. Other professionals, namely nurses, can provide these basic health services. So it is and will embrace a shift in responsibilities of roles and tasks. Certainly monitoring is very important, and to do so looking more at outcomes and impact in particular, showing that it's made a difference in reducing disease burden. So I wanted to leave you with a few key messages. It's universal health coverage is the application of the right to health. It's tackling the issues of the disparities we see in Latin America and the Caribbean, as defined by the World Bank, the region of the greatest disparities. So equity and solidarity continues to be guiding principles going forward. It needs that political will and certainly the financial protection that I also mentioned. We do believe that fees at the moment of seeking care is an impediment. Public health needs, in most countries, perhaps not all, but in most countries, needs greater investment. And it will be an issue that cries for bottom-up as well as top-down strategies. But the marriage of the two, not neglecting bottom-up approaches as we have in the past. So in ending, we see universal health coverage as a development issue and a key component of the way we structure our systems going forward after 2015. And we do have ways of monitoring this, and I proposed one at the beginning, maternal deaths, as an indicator of one of many that could be used to ensuring universal health coverage. Again, thank you very much, and thank you, Dr. Trautman, for inviting me.
Good afternoon. I don't have slides, so I can maybe direct your attention over here. First of all, let me say I'm Dr. Nils Dallaire. I'm the Assistant Secretary for Global Affairs at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It's a real privilege and a pleasure to be here with some of the distinguished speakers with us today. As has already been noted, and as you'll hear coming forward over the next few minutes, expanding access to health coverage is an issue of importance that goes far beyond our own borders. And I want to thank Dr. Trautman for taking the lead in organizing today's panel. I attended my first APHA meeting as a student 35 years ago, and it really is an honor to be invited here to discuss one of the key public health challenges and opportunities of our time. This discussion is timely because as we take a step back to look at the global picture, we see a world of rising economic disparity in which access to affordable care has become more and more critical. Disease burden is more and more a key marker of inequity, and wellness is the ultimate equalizer. Worldwide, rising rates of chronic non-communicable diseases and changing patterns of morbidity and mortality are placing enormous stresses on national healthcare delivery and public health systems. Since the turn of the century, this has become increasingly a global trend, seen in every country around the world, regardless of level of economic development. I frequently travel around the world representing Secretary Sebelius and the U.S. government in health discussions and negotiations with other governments, international research institutions, and multilateral bodies such as those represented by my friends here today. While there are many topics on which global health leaders may not see exactly eye to eye, there is broad agreement that while no silver bullet exists to eliminate health disparities, universal health coverage is the most powerful tool that we do have. I've worked in global health, which we used to call international health, for more than three decades, and I'm proud to serve under a president who so deeply understands the importance of healthcare access for both the health of a country's citizens and for the economy of the nation. Here in the U.S., as many of you know, we spend $2.8 trillion each year on healthcare, which is far more per capita than any other nation. This represents nearly one of every $5 used in our economy, a level of nearly twice that of our nearest competitor, if you can call it competitor. But as everyone in this room knows, this is not making us healthier. It is just helping us to spend more and more in an apparently endless spiral. Like many other countries in the world, part of our problem is uneven access to healthcare, especially preventive services. We live in a country with some of the best clinical specialists in the world, and yet many Americans not only do not have access to those specialists once they're sick, and worse yet, cannot even access basic preventive services. As I said, wellness is the great equalizer, and our health system has generally ignored this vital issue. The Affordable Care Act addresses this key driver of health inequity by making increased access a reality. As part of the new law, millions of Americans will be able to obtain affordable coverage and access to a broad range of preventive services, treatment, and care. And we're getting closer to the day when no family in the U.S. will be driven to bankruptcy by the cost of the medical bills needed to save a loved one's life. Now, we recognize that no one-size-fits-all model for universal health care exists. National governments have many paths towards its realization. Around the world, countries have successfully taken different approaches to healthcare coverage in regard to services, cost sharing, financing, and organization. All have their particular advantages, and each has its unique shortcomings. However, while it is the responsibility of individual governments to decide how each will make health coverage a reality, it is our shared burden and shared responsibility to work together towards these goals. President Obama has reminded us that access to health care is, and I quote, not some earned privilege, it is a right. When he said those words, he enabled those of us who serve in his administration to say it for the first time ever in global fora such as the World Health Organization. And that means that we now have the opportunity to work together with the nations of the world to begin to ensure that everyone in the world has access to the services that they need. Part of this global work takes place at the United Nations. The U.S. was proud to co-sponsor a United Nations General Assembly resolution last year promoting universal health coverage, emphasizing social protection, as we heard a few moments ago, and sustainable financing. And we also co-sponsored a resolution at the World Health Assembly on developing the health workforce by promoting education to meet the needs of universal health coverage. There continues to be much to be done and much to learn from one another. I want to commend Taiwan, and we'll be hearing from them in a few minutes, for the impressive achievements of their national health insurance model. They have achieved 99.8% coverage with one of the lowest administrative costs in the world, and this is a remarkable feat. I would just note, I would like to see your website, please. I do applaud the leadership role that PAHO has taken, including the recent strategic consultative meeting on achieving universal health coverage. These meetings are important as they provide an opportunity not only to share what is working, but to collectively address the challenges. Now, while political leadership is essential, academic institutions and practitioners have a vital role to play in training the next generation of health leaders. Today, there's a tidal wave of students looking to get into careers in global public health, both here in the U.S. and abroad. And we need to ensure that the structures are in place for these brilliant young women and men to be able to make the meaningful global impact that they desire. Making a positive impact on health requires more than producing sheer numbers of health professionals, however. It requires people who can build strong health systems, ensure available financing, and implement policies that allow access to essential medicines and technologies. And yet, even when these components are in place, there are still challenges to equitable access to care. For instance, in every country throughout the world, including our own, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, or LGBT, persons experience poorer health outcomes and worse access to essential care than does the general population. While more data is needed on the drivers of this health inequity, the research that we have confirms that many barriers to accessing care come directly from the health sector and can be traced to stigma and discrimination based on misunderstanding and prejudice among health providers about homosexuality, gender identity, and expression. President Obama has made ending discrimination against the LGBT population a top priority of his administration, not only domestically, but on the global stage. I'm proud to say that a few weeks ago, the U.S. government introduced, and all the member states of the Americas region passed, a resolution at the Pan American Health Organization's annual meeting recognizing the need to address discrimination in the health sector against LGBT persons. This marks the first time ever that a UN body has recognized the need to address discrimination in the health sector against LGBT persons. Some have deemed this a historic step. The underlying lesson is that universal access requires reaching all populations, including those at the margins of our societies. If we create a system which excludes any population, the poor, the disabled, those with mental health needs, then a portion of universal health care becomes an illusion, and we have no right to use the term universal. We also need to make sure that systems are in place to be able to address the most pressing health needs facing our people, especially the poor and dispossessed. Traditional health work has been organized around managing acute conditions. However, while this continues to be vital, today what increasingly plagues people living at the economic margins of the world's burgeoning megacities in low and middle-income countries are chronic non-communicable diseases. Cancers, cardiovascular diseases, chronic lung diseases, and diabetes are now the world's leading cause of death and disability, and particularly in low-income countries, they predominantly affect younger people. And while unacceptably high and readily preventable maternal, neonatal, infant, and child mortality and its drivers are still the unfinished business of the 20th century, and we heard about the Millennium Development Goals just a few minutes ago, we do the world's poor a disservice by pretending that non-communicable diseases are problems only of the affluent, not any longer. Given this shift in disease trends, we need to focus more than ever on prevention and the management of chronic conditions. And the global community is coming together in a remarkable fashion to do just that. In September 2011, the UN held a high-level meeting on non-communicable diseases at the United Nations General Assembly. This was only the second ever high-level UN meeting focused on a single health issue. The first was on HIV/AIDS in the year 2000. And look at what's happened in the world since that meeting took place. Since the 2011 meeting, the World Health Organization has developed a global action plan on non-communicable diseases, establishing 9 global targets on preventing early deaths, reducing risk factors, and addressing some of the health system's issues necessary to do both. Working closely with CDC, NIH, and other parts of HHS, my office has been actively involved in negotiations to make sure that those targets are realistic, meaningful, and can be met by countries at every level of development. Given today's global state of limited resources, access for all to quality services for the most prevalent diseases, including those preventive services, is a critical component. There is no easy path to universal health coverage, but it is not an impossible road ahead. Ensuring access to non-discriminatory health care is a goal that all countries can and should support. Bridging religious and cultural differences, we are united in recognizing the fundamental principle of making sure that every person can see a health provider when they're injured, get medicine when they are sick, and have lifelong access to the basic preventive care necessary to live a healthy and active life. Our work means that the generations to come will have the opportunity to live happier, healthier lives. And as a son, husband, parent, and grandparent myself, that could not please me more. I'd like to leave you with a quote from Dr. Margaret Chan, Director General of the World Health Organization, formerly Director of Public Health Services for Hong Kong, and a dear friend. She said, "Universal coverage is the single most powerful concept that public health has to offer. It is the best way to cement the health gains made during the previous decade. It is a powerful social equalizer and the ultimate expression of fairness." Thank you very much.